Oh, image of my divine Godhead, ennobled by my humanity, adorned by my Holy Spirit, what is thy treasure called? And she finally gives in, Lord, it is called my heart's desire. I have withdrawn it from the world, denied it to myself and all creatures. Now I can bear it no longer. Where, O Lord, shall I lay it? And then he says, thy heart's desire shalt thou lay nowhere but in my own divine heart and on my own human breast. There alone will you find comfort and be embraced by my spirit. So she too, with all of these images of the world around her and the soul like the deer, looks deeply into the heart of the world to hear the heartbeat of God. Okay, now don't be intimidated by these people. we have these records of people who, you know, stand the test of time and the fortune of having documents preserved, whom we might associate as great mystics. And we have people who have, in fact, made something of a vocation of a commitment to a religious mystical life. But that's not the important expression of it. The important expression of mysticism is the ordinary, everyday experiences of mysticism that people have. And I've found in talking with groups before that after you get talking a little while, you find out that there's really nobody that hasn't had an experience of mysticism. And so I want to ask this question again. Have you had experiences of ordinary mysticism? And as you think about them, moments of kind of when you sense something of the transcendent and the otherness in the most ordinary things, in what way was creation present there? Yes.
I have an experience that stands out, which I considered mystic when it happened. It was a February day, and I had joined a friend to do some hiking in northern Minnesota, something I had always wanted to do, and that he had the skills to do. We'd driven up there, we'd unpacked our gear, he described a little bit what we were going to do, and we started down this frozen stream on what was the first mile, it would be an 8 mile hike. And we broke out into the sun beside a frozen lake, and there were all these small alders standing, forming kind of a screen at the shore of the lake, but also a path along the walk we were going to take. And I felt an overwhelming need to thank somebody for something.
Huh. This is like Alyosha, yeah.
Came up as I hit that lake.
Yes, and it still is poignant with you when you recall it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember one time, one doesn't expect mystical experiences in six-cylinder car, engine cars. But I was going to a retreat on the eastern shore of Maryland and simply driving down the road and it was October, and it was sunset, and the sky was just, well, as Aldo Leopold says of a river in Wisconsin at even, nature was in a painting mood. Well, nature was in a painting mood across the sky, and there were one line, V-shaped, of geese after another, as far as you could see, across the colors of the sunset. And I simply had to stop and watch this, take it in. And that's as vivid for me now, I think, as it was then. And I had the same kind of response as you do. One has to say thanks to the universe or God or someone or something at that moment. You're just kind of overcome by it.
Sunset seemed to be a thing that startles one, and I had that same sunset experience in Hong Kong. And then I was told that the reason that sunset was so absolutely magnificent was because of the pollution.
Yes, all the particles in the air. Yeah, it might have been sand somewhere else, but not in Hong Kong. In New Mexico, it's the dust and the sand, but not in Hong Kong. Yes.
Rainbows usually have an effect on people.
Do they?
We live in a beautiful mountain area, and especially like morning rainbows because they frame the mountains.
Oh my!
I see one. It's thank God for this experience. I mean, nobody else could have created that. But one in particular we'll never forget. Last spring, my wife had a hospice patient in the nursing home. No family there. And she stayed with this patient and promised him that she would be there when he died. And we got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, went down to the nursing home, waited for 2 or 3 hours, and he died. And we went home and saw a rainbow out of our window. And my comment was, there goes Buddy's climbing the rainbow. And, you know, you don't get over things like that.
Yeah.
I had an experience after our first child was born. It's not the birth of the child, which you expected me to do this sort of experience, and it was pretty cool. But afterward, when she was in the hospital with Karen and I was out doing whatever business I had to do, I walked out of my car in a parking lot and I saw people milling about, and it suddenly occurred to me that all these people, every single person around me was once a baby. And it was just the most remarkable thing to contemplate, an idea of what really is the stuff of the world. The stuff of humanity is about babies becoming something else. And I was really just stunned by what is something I really should have known. somehow took on a very profound meaning for
me. It's just nice. Yeah.
I've been struck several times by hiking a wilderness area similar to this one. I'm in Three Sisters Just Wilderness in Oregon. And just overwhelmed by the massive space around me and the amount of organisms alive in that space, yet it's absolutely quiet. It's just so overwhelming. And, you know, sometimes it rises up fear, because in some of those times I've been alone and had some of the most vivid dreams of my life. But to be alone and to have that kind of silence, you are really confronted with God.
Yes, I'm sure there's a reason also why the mystics, you know, seek solitude. Your comment about fear is an important one, and in the mystical visions that we have, in the testimony of mystics, it isn't always and only a positive experience. You know, it's sometimes being confronted by the enormity of it all, or the emptiness of it all. You experience the fullness of it all, the silence of it all, but there are many, many dimensions of mysticism where one is simply transported outside, out of oneself into something that is just overwhelming in any number possible directions. It may be very painful. Yeah.
I was impressed with your choice of references, Bingen and Merton and Chardin, all authors I've read and been concerned for their thoughts and why they were driven to their thoughts. I guess in some of the greatest writing of this sort does come from the physical scientists who were in paleontology.
Yeah.
Because the discovery over the last two centuries of how long it's been and how complicated a process it is just overwhelms the mind.
Yeah.
I would recommend Lauren Isley too.
Oh yes, Lauren Isley is a wonderful science author who has the capacity to express it. In the language of the mystic.
He was in the end a mystic.
Lauren Isley is wonderful. And who is the author of Lewis Thomas also, Lives of a Cell? There's another scientist. When a number of the prominent scientists, many of whom from the physical scientists, and some of them like Carl Sagan from astrophysics, gathered in New York at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, many of them were not believers. But they wrote an open letter to religious leaders in the United States talking about the threat to life on this planet at our hands now. And they used the language of, they said, our experience as scientists is an experience of something that is sacred. And that's not a scientific thing to say. It's not a science word.
Mm-hmm.
But that was their experience as scientists.
Yes.
And it was very interesting. I mean, when Carl Sagan died, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine was full. That's 6,000 people. And he himself would not have called himself, or did say, I am not a believer, but nonetheless, there was something appropriate to that setting for his funeral.
I offer a different mystical experience, not terribly different, but in the sense that it wasn't surprising or instantaneous. I lived in Florence on the Oregon coast for a while, and would often go for walks out on the dunes, and I consider them meditative walks, and often, I guess what I consider mystical experiences for me, in terms of seeing objects, parts of the creation, which would sort of flash insight or deeper understanding, appreciation of something to you. But the interesting thing about all that for me is that desert's not the right word because it's cool and rainy, but sandy, desert-like environment where life is twisted and tortured.
Yeah.
And I often think of the church fathers or mothers who will come out of desert experience and see in the minutiae a reflection of human experience. And you get trees that are just like this because of the rains and the sands and things. And there's these bursts of understanding about what life does to you or things like that. So it kind of sequential flashes of mysticism in different events.
Yeah. I have not read Annie Diller's new book. What is it called?
For the Time Being.
Dorothy Bass was telling me about it yesterday, but part of that is her mystical, her looking at something, it may be the skin of a snake, you know. Her contemplation of that, and then the kind of the whole story of evolution and the suffering, the predatory character of much of this episode. So it isn't. Some of it is seeing the twisted and the malformed and the deformed. Yeah, Stacy, and then Krista.
I was thinking of another book, and I mentioned this when we were talking about sacramentalism, Annie Dillard's book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Oh, yeah.
She talks about being a child and putting pennies out on the street, hoping that someone would one day find this penny. And I think, I can't remember, but she always ended up finding the penny or something. I might be misquoting it. But she also talks about this girl who could not see, and talking about the, and then catching glimpses of light and seeing the tree with the lights in it. And Annie Dillard searched along Tinker Creek forever for this tree with lights in it. And at one moment she saw this. And she said, you know, I was a bell just waiting to be rung. And I'm misquoting her. I apologize to Annie. But I think that the mysticism is in that brief moment that is always there, that tree was always there. Mm-hmm. It's just that she had the eyes to finally see it.
Yeah.
And I think of being on Lake Superior and swimming late at night and putting my clothes back on and just looking out at the right time and seeing that just sliver of red at the bottom of the horizon, which was the moon rising. And had I not been there at that moment, I would have missed it, yet it's always there also. So I think that's the... There are so many moments where, whether it be a sunrise, a sunset, a shooting star, that they're always happening, but our eyes just have to be attuned to them.
Yeah.
If you want to have a mystical thought, ask yourself how it is that all of us share that incredible sense of beauty at sights like that. Mm-hmm. Where did we learn that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that many mystical moments can be passed off quickly as simply our imagination. But I think once you're attuned to a meditative state or a real state of awareness, that you can distinguish between something that is not coming from you, that and make a difference between what is coming from you and what you're receiving. You know, when you are looking at that red band, there's more than beauty. There's something else that you're attuned to. And I think we're not used to talking about that kind of experience. And it's really fun to listen right now to people talking about it. It's not usual to talk about it, and I think that's a real loss in our culture.
Yeah. When you... so often you find that you've got all these closet mystics sitting around you. And where it shows up, I found in teaching, is when you ask people to do journaling, you know, as an assignment for a class. Very often the mysticism comes through in people's journal entries. But you're right. We don't talk about it. Incidentally, Kristen's the artist that did the Tree of Life up there. Stacy mentioned there's always a tree there, but you don't always see it. That one's from the 22nd chapter of Revelation.
Well, that one may have come partly from a long ago mystical experience looking at a tree. And all of a sudden I saw the tree in my mind's eye as every leaf was a diamond.
Oh.
And you know, was that my imagination?
Uh-huh.
Or where did that come from?
Yeah, yeah.
And what that meant for me, you know, if I was a poet, I would write that the sacredness of that tree was showing through in the diamond brilliance of those leaves.
Yes, please.
I usually receive that kind of a moment from my sense of smell. Like,
oh, yeah.
To the garden and rub your hand up some rosemary.
Uh-huh.
You know, put your face in basil or something, some smell that can just make you want to lie down and be as still as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point. I'm glad for these different dimensions, and one thing that I do want to underscore, lest we miss it, is that in the accounts of the mystics, ordinary and otherwise, it is a mysticism of all of the senses. You know, when you read the mystical visions or these prayers of mystics, they are just the most sensuous epistles, because all of the senses are engaged. There, it's images, it's smells, it's the breeze. I mean, it's touch. It's just all there. Yes, please.
Well, mine's a little bit different, but we live in a community where Matthew Shepard was raised.
Oh my, yeah.
And
in Laramie, and are you in
Casper, Wyoming?
Okay.
And he attended the preschool in our church, and even though his family left before we were personally involved, we didn't know him. But we attended a candlelight vigil the night before he was killed. And then the next day, the community was pretty upset because we're the state that prides ourselves on being the equality state.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, we were being bombarded by the press. Hate groups from Kansas were planning to come to the funeral, which was held in Casper. I work in a very large high school in the downtown area, and there was question about whether we could even have school that day because of the amount of press and how much was going to be cordoned off downtown and so forth and so on. And the day of the funeral, it started to snow as the angels of mercy protected the family with the white robes. And I couldn't help but think that God was crying and protected all of us in kind of a neat way, because he cut down the power, he broke the trees, it was very early fall. He canceled our crop walk. But I couldn't help but think that had some way protected the whole city as well as the family from a lot of pretty abusive things that could have happened in the
Larry?
Yeah.
What was Deschanel's quote about love and fire? Do you call that?
From what I read, or another?
No. Something about if we ever discover love.
Yeah. Yes, we will have.
Or discovered fire for the second time. Or
yeah.
Something.
Right. Yeah. 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 I don't remember what the description of love was, the qualification of. But if we ever discovered that, or we experienced that love fully, we would have discovered fire for the second time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Question of time. To go somewhere else.
Go ahead. Yeah, our time is about to take this day.
It's about mysticism, but it's sort of about the other great traditions you're talking about. In these traditions that span religions.
Yes, as they all do.
As they all do, and focus on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
What makes mysticism Christian, or ask by the way, where does the person of Jesus fit into these sorts of things for the mystics?
Yes. Well, almost all of the mystics, when they speak of Christ, and all of the Christian mystics do at some point or another. I mean, it varies from one to another. It's almost always a cosmic Christ, and it's seeing in Christ the Christ of the fourth gospel. In Him were all things created, or the Christ of Colossians. It's often the Chardin has this whole evolutionary schema in terms of Alpha and Omega, and Christ is the Omega point. So it's almost always there as a cosmic presence that one has seen incarnated in Jesus of Nazareth. The only exception to that I can think of is that in Celtic mysticism, you often have a very human Jesus and kind of left there, but as a part of the mystical, you look into the very human face of Jesus, or the very human face of Mary, who's always a peasant girl, or I mean, she's an Irish farm girl, you know, or a Scottish farm girl, and then looking there, one looks into the face of God. Now that may be looking to the face of Jesus that isn't this kind of cosmic Christ, but most of the time it's this It's a Christ of Paul has a very strong mystical dimension, and for him it's this cosmic Christ.
And
the Christ mysticism.
For Mother Teresa, I mean, I think that she's not seen as a mystic, but there's, I think, some of the mystic, and certainly some of the contemplative in her, and her ability to see Christ. She's got a wonderful phrase, which of course I can't remember, about Christ in his something or other disguise.
Yes.
The people dying on the streets of
Calcutta. Yeah.
And for her, those moments of transcendence are transcendence in the presence of Christ.
Yeah.
Very definitely.
Dorothy Day was like that as well.
For me, I think what makes my mystical experience, I feel a little odd using that term, but Christian has more to do with my response to them than the experience itself.
Maybe it doesn't, I guess I don't know that we need to make a mystical experience Christian necessarily.
No.
What I'm grappling with, I guess, is if to be Christian community is to be community that witnesses to a historical event, death, resurrection of Jesus, is that just different than the traditions that are taking us towards an earth healing place? Or do a cosmic Christ seem like a pretty, I understand John goes there and Paul goes there, but it's a pretty strong stretch from witness to death and resurrection in the person as an event. You know? So I'm just trying to find where those things dovetail.
That's an interesting question. If you think about Merton, the impression he leaves me is he's on a first name basis with God. He's dealing directly with God. and the relationship to the historical event that you're talking about does not come through that much in his writing.
Yeah. That's very often the case with mystics, you know, and that's part of the nature of mysticism is this transcending of history and society into another world, and yet at the same time, it's as I mentioned earlier, it's often because of intense contemplation of something in this world, and often being overwhelmed by some experience in this world. Merton, incidentally, there's Merton wrote I don't know umpteen volumes, and there have been umpteen more volumes written about Merton. But one of them that needs to be written yet and hasn't been is Merton the Naturalist, because he would sit in his hermitage in Gethsemane, Kentucky, and contemplate that leaf on the tree or the branch or the insect on the railing there and give the most exquisite descriptions of what he saw. And it only shows, he never wrote a book about it, it only shows up in his journal entries. But I've often thought, I bet there's a connection between Merton the Naturalist and Merton the Contemplative. You know, it's part of that focus. Last thing, time really is up now. I don't know how long you folks are around here. Certainly staff will be around when Cindy Molibita comes. And she's a doctoral student at Union in Christian Ethics. She lives in Seattle. And she's going to be, her dissertation is on globalization and mysticism. and she's looking to mysticism as a source for a strong sense of moral energy, if you will, and another vision so as to be able to combat this description that I read from Gottlieb. And it's a very interesting way to do things. And there will be a book coming soon, that Dorothea Zola, a German Lutheran theologian, regards as her magnum opus on mysticism and revolution. And Dorothea's contention is that when the mystic returns from the mystical experience, she or he is not the same and has been in touch with another world and has an energy which just won't be stopped. There are no sanctions that you can place on the mystic that are going to be very effective in changing that one. So I do think that there is a very strong earth, return to earth, and it may be, like you said, it's the response in which maybe the mystical moment has its apex there. The world is seen in a kind of cosmic beauty and harmony that is a burden for the mystic. And the mystic cannot leave the broken world in the same place because the mystic is burdened with this experience of beauty and harmony of all things in God. Thank you.
Thank you.